10 days ago, law students voted to call for an academic boycott of Israel at McGill. And the university isn't happy, with McGill president Deep Saini calling it discriminatory and invalid, and once again threatening to cut ties with the student union over Palestine solidarity. On March 21st, the Law Students Association, or LSA, held a referendum on an amendment to their constitution for a boycott of Israeli cultural and educational bodies. Now, this is one of the classic pillars of BDS, boycott, divestment, and sanctions that the pro-Palestine movement has long called for. And this vote was supported by almost 60% of voters. But in the days that followed, the outcome has been condemned in the media, by McGill's administration, and with a court challenge by another law student. Now, that challenge was denied on Friday when the Superior Court of Montreal found that student Rachel Harosh's application failed to meet the threshold, demonstrating urgency and irreparable harm. But that doesn't mean that the story is over. Joining us to discuss are two representatives of Law Students for Palestine, Finn Jacobson and Iman Sattar. Finn and Iman, thanks for coming on CKUT.
Hi. Thanks for having us, Jules.
So you passed this referendum question for a boycott at McGill's Law School almost 2 weeks ago now, and you've gotten this huge response. How are you guys feeling, first of all?
We're feeling super great and hopeful that the students have spoken. It was a majority vote. We had a 67.3% turnout, which is the highest in the McGill Law Students Association, so the LSA, in recent history. And students voted 57% in favor of this referendum.
When you saw not just the, you know, support from the law students, but also just the pushback from the administration, from some members of the media, from some McGill donors, how did that feel?
I definitely think it feels like completely disproportional to me. I think, like, especially, you know, the law faculty is not a large faculty at the school. And we did a referendum for our student union, and to have friends that I know that went to McGill years ago, like in completely different programs, getting like email blasts, and obviously they don't know anything about the whole story of the referendum because like most people aren't tapped into a faculty that they aren't a part of student politics, and then just to have it become this really big divisive thing. Like, I mean, I don't think the referendum itself needed to be like this big of a talking point. So it's interesting to see it being like broadcast and in such a negative light.
Well, let's talk about the referendum itself. You said that, like, most people don't actually know the facts of what was on the ballot here. What are those facts?
Yeah, I mean, so the referendum, the official title of the referendum is called the Referendum Regarding the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel to Preserve Academic Freedom. So that was essentially contextualized in the fact that the McGill Faculty of Law having an academic exchange partnership with Tel Aviv University. And it's supposed to be the only exchange partnership that we have in the Middle East, so-called Middle East. And, you know, Finn and I and a couple of our colleagues at Law Students for Palestine McGill have done extensive research just trying to understand how is Tel Aviv University complicit in the ongoing occupation and genocide of Palestinians? And we were trying to uncover, you know, how is this harmful? How does this threaten academic freedom when we have and continue to have an exchange partnership with them? The institution itself has a partnership called the Institute of National Security Studies, also known as the INSS. And essentially what happens is that there's kind of like a pipeline that the university facilitates between them and this institution, where there's a lot of legal academics that end up going from Tel Aviv Faculty of Law to INSS to essentially work with Israeli military personnel to manufacture legal scholarship and arguments to continue to justify Israeli war crimes and the tactics that they use against Palestinians to commit this genocide.
And this is a university where McGill was sending students on exchange.
Exactly.
Do you know if there were students who were at this INSS?
Not that we know of.
And so why is it important for you guys to, cut the link of students who are maybe going to Tel Aviv University studying, but even if they're not at this institute, what's the importance of calling on the school to make sure that people don't go again?
I mean, for me, I think it's important. Like, I think some of the doctrine that Iman just mentioned, like, this is legal doctrine that's being developed at TAU, and I don't think that should be, like, upheld as law and as international law that is, you know, valid and that we should respect. And so to send students that are, you know, graduating with a McGill degree to an institute that is creating and proliferating law that I don't think aligns with what I would hope McGill views as valid international law, I just think that it casts doubt to me on the value of our degrees and the value of the law that we're being taught, if that counts as the same.
Mm-hmm. And what has been the response? So, you know, before you got the response from the wider public who was learning about this and the higher McGill administration, what was the response in the law school when you first launched this campaign? How are people defending, first of all, these types of partnerships, whether it's the dean of the Faculty of Law or students who have, you know, voted against this, as I guess 40% have?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting that you bring up this question, because I think over the years, kind of leading up to October 7, 2023, there's always been this constant pushback where there would be a denial of, you know, the facts and the war crimes that are constantly perpetrated by Israel. And I think we're kind of seeing a shift where there's an overall sentiment where people do sympathize with the plight of Palestinians. And I think it's like common knowledge, you know, especially after the McGill encampments, that, you know, this is wrong. We need to boycott. We need to divest. And what we kind of saw during the campaign for our referendum, there was a no campaign that came out led by the JLSA, the Jewish Law Students Association. And one of their main arguments was that, you know, we don't disagree that everything that is happening is wrong, you know, because what do they have to disagree about? You know, you cannot contest the fact that, you know, children and women and men are being indiscriminately murdered by, you know, Israeli soldiers and artificial intelligence, right? You know, even with the whole passing of, you know, this law about the death penalty, implementing the death penalty for Palestinians. Like, all that to say is they kind of conceded that, you know, what is happening is wrong. And what I find really funny about law students and lawyers is that when you can't argue the facts, you have to argue on procedure. And so that's essentially what happened. I don't know if you'd like to elaborate on that, Finn.
It's exactly what Iman's describing. It was yeah, there was absolutely no real pushback on the substance of our referendum from our student body, from the No campaign at the time. Like, we didn't hear anything from the administration directly. It was just, oh, this is going to be complicated. McGill's going to, you know, pursue legal action. They're going to cut ties. It's going to be this big thing. And yeah, like, the people that we spoke to, nobody was sort of even trying to defend a partnership with Tel Aviv. I don't know if they were doing it privately, but, like, I didn't hear any of that. And the No campaign didn't publicly say any of that. It was just that it's gonna cause legal action, and also, like, other procedural complaints, like, we, you know, instituted the wrong procedure, which we had, like, already went through all the steps for that. But, yeah, it's more just, like, specifics of how the voting should go and how we should implement this kind of practice and how we should push for Palestinian, like, liberation and things. It's nobody's even really interested in having the debate anymore of whether this is important and whether this is right.
If I may add, they brought up a financial argument, saying that, you know, if you do pass this referendum, there's going to be some kind of, you know, litigation, and that's going to drown the Law Students Association in a bunch of legal fees, and you're going to lose, you know, all your funding to access, you know, clubs and skit night and all these fun activities that we normally have. And so there was, like, you know, this fear tactic that was employed by the No campaign. And you asking this great question, why was there like a 40% turnout for the No campaign? I would also attribute that to some interference on the part of the McGill administration.
Well, let's talk about it, because as I understand it, on the eve of the referendum, which is not to say the night before, but just before it's getting started, the voting is getting started, Angela Campbell, who any McGill listeners will know this name, she's always around, you know, one of the senior administrators at McGill sent out this email basically threatening the students. Quote, in our assessment, the amendment is contrary to the LSA's memorandum of agreement with the university and, if adopted, would place the association in default of its obligations and guiding principles. Now, for those of you who have listened to my show for the last few years, I mean, McGill's Undergraduate Students Association, the SSMU, has been threatened with McGill cutting ties with them and their memorandum of agreement several times over the past few years for basically every pro-Palestine thing that they did. McGill has a history of taking legal action against groups, and now, you know, as soon as it was passed, basically, Deep Saini, McGill's president, has said, this is what we plan to do. We plan to cut ties if the Law Students Association continues. Where are you guys at now with this?
I'll say I did research on this because this was raised vaguely by the No campaign at the time of campaigning. We didn't hear directly from McGill at that time, but that this may be a concern. So I went into the MOA. I was looking for what we may have, you know, misstepped on or something. And there's really nothing that we've violated in that. Obviously, the MOA keeps us bound under general, like a variety of McGill general rules, but like McGill has yet to highlight specifically what, if there's something that they think we have misstepped. Like they'd say things like, the charter, McGill's Charter of Student Rights and Policy on Harassment and Discrimination. Earlier we heard the Student Code of Conduct was one of them. So yeah, we've heard like documents, but no specific sort of like rules. And all that the MOA says and all that they keep pointing to is that they can file for default.
Do you find it ironic as law students that the, you know, response is always go to the courts, drown you in documents, make you pay for lawyers?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's lucky that we're law students. I think it's a good thing for us to be doing this because, you know, those kind of vague threats don't work on us in the same way. Like, we're willing to actually look into the writing and what's actually at play, so.
And speaking of the legal system, one of your fellow law students tried to file a provisional injunction. So for any listeners, this is the first step of an injunction, the most immediate in the cases that McGill has filed in the past against student protesters, including the encampment, you know, when they try and file for an injunction. The provisional one is step one. It's usually like a bounded period of time, and it's before all the information can come in and everything can be argued in depth. So one of your fellow law students, Rachel Hirosh, tried to do this last week. You guys were in court on Thursday. On Friday, you found that she failed. Can you tell me more about this first victory so far within the courts? And how it feels to be there. Were you expecting to be taken to court so soon?
I mean, as soon as we heard of the results, it was kind of like clockwork. We got a DM via Instagram from like an Instagram bailiff being like, hey,
Instagram bailiff.
We had no idea that this was actually a thing. So, you know, I mean, first year of law school, you
McGill
learn a lot.
Law isn't teaching you everything.
No, certainly not. And we were in court on Thursday. So it was essentially filing a provisional injunction against essentially the implementation of this referendum. But I think what's important to note about this provisional injunction is that it's only granted in very extreme and urgent situations, kind of like a 911 type of situation. And basically the crux of, you know, the whole hearing itself was that they were unable to substantiate those claims as to why they needed a provisional injunction. Like, there was no immediate threat, so-called immediate threat of discrimination and all that sort of stuff. So, yeah.
But that doesn't mean there's no long-term potential threat, is what you're saying. So they could theoretically go and try and use the courts again and marshal some different arguments for some different type of court case or injunction. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you know, I think this is a pattern that we see, you know, over the years with anything Palestine related, even with the McGill encampments. Like, I think, you know, Zionists will always find a way to kind of manufacture some sort of threat to silence, you know, the freedom, the speech of students, you know, the majority of what people are saying, what the students want at McGill University. And, you know, we have a term for this. We call this legal warfare or lawfare, where, you know, whether it's, you know, the Zionists or McGill University essentially dragging students to court to silence them.
But, I mean, as we saw with the undergraduate students, this happened many times. McGill threatened. There were injunctions against various referendum questions and policies. But in the end, I mean, things did get passed and students did go to court and they changed their own documents to make them strong. You know, there has been progress over these years of fighting. Looking ahead for you, what's next as you now, as law students, deal with these similar challenges?
Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult position we're in right now because it's a bit of a waiting game, because most of the things like complaints and any legal action has to be initiated by the complainant. So, like, we're just kind of waiting to see. But now, like, we don't have the provisional injunction. Like, in theory, the bylaws are in effect. So we're hoping, we can move forward with that and just do what the people voted to do. So,
And what's your message to listeners, just to close out a long and very thoughtful interview?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of momentum that's happening, and I highly encourage, you know, all students who are listening right now to mobilize your faculty and to please do not hesitate to reach out to us at the law faculty at Law Students for Palestine McGill. We would be extremely happy to help students, you know, pass referendums. And, you know, hopefully we can gather a few faculties to really exert as much pressure as we can on the McGill administration to ultimately divest. This isn't the first time that it's happened. It's happened in 1985 with apartheid South Africa. We had around, like, I think 2 to 3 faculties that you know, joined forces to really work over the years to get the Senate and eventually the Board of Governors to divest. So there's certainly hope, and I would highly encourage you all to just, you know, ride on that momentum and please reach out.
All right. Thank you both for coming on CKUT. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much. Jules.
That was Finn and Iman from the Law Students for Palestine at McGill. You're listening to CKUT. We'll be back in just a minute.